Good morning and welcome to our Tineo Insights call. Brexit, ESG, the US election, we've taken on some major topics in recent weeks. But today we're back with the biggest of them all, COVID-19. In the last week, the President of the United States got the virus. There was another fiasco where it seems thousands of positive tests got missed because the system they were being stored on didn't have enough memory. Scotland is shutting all pubs and restaurants again, and it looks like further restrictions are coming to much of the rest of the UK. Boris Johnson tried to cheer everyone up with a boosterish speech at a virtual Tory conference, but reading between the lines of his Chancellor's comments, it's clear taxes are going to have to rise and the ceaseless spending is going to have to stop after what promises to be a difficult winter. Keir Starmer claimed the government had lost control of events. 6 months into the deep restrictions, one thing is clear. We're going to be living with coronavirus a good while longer. What's it going to look like, and what should the response of business be? We have the perfect panel to help answer those questions. Alison Rose is the CEO of NatWest Group. She'll be talking about how the bank is helping and coping with coronavirus. Ruth Sunderland is the business editor of the Daily Mail. She'll be explaining what arguably Britain's most influential newspaper expects from business. Anna Hill is general manager of WW, formerly known as Weight Watchers. She's seen huge changes affecting her business accelerate massively during the pandemic. And Amber Rudd, who's been a regular on these calls, will be trying to explain what's going on in government. Before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the top right of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, apart from Ruth, of course, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcasts or publication at all. Alison, let's start with you. As a CEO of a major bank, you're in many ways in the front line of the response to coronavirus, certainly around the economy. Tell us about what you're seeing and doing about it.
Thanks, Craig. Well, certainly COVID's been a tremendous test of resilience, and I'm sure it's challenged everyone in terms of resolving and addressing the situation. I think what we've seen is businesses had to find very creative solutions to problems that it could never have imagined in order to respond very quickly. And we've all had to operate in a very dynamic and uncertain environment, and that uncertainty shows no signs of abating. Certainly for me, when I took over the role of CEO of NatWest and announced my strategy on the 14th of February, I didn't have a global pandemic in my year one plan. So we've had to pivot pretty rapidly to deal with the situation. And I think in terms of how we've responded, it's very much about recognising this isn't a business as usual situation. We announced a new purpose-led strategy around balancing the needs of all of our stakeholders, but we recognised this wasn't business as usual. So we pivoted very rapidly to firstly getting our organisation so we could continue with business continuity. So that's meant 50,000 of my colleagues were moved to working from home and continue to do so. We kept all of our branches open, around 95% of them broadly are open right the way through, which means there is active service for our customers on the front line and balancing the safety of my colleagues as well as continuity of service to customer has been a key aspect. And I think using the purpose that we announced has really galvanized the bank to respond. But what we've had to do is respond very quickly in terms of decision making and need of customers. So firstly, we mobilised the support behind the government schemes to make sure that we could get financing and funds to businesses that in some cases were about to run out of money in a matter of weeks or facing real stress around how they deal with this situation. We saw record volumes coming into our call centres, into our bank. But at the end of June, we'd supported 23% of our mortgage customers to have repayment holidays in case they needed it. Not all of them have needed it, but it was there as support. We've delivered 25% of all lending through the government schemes to small and medium-sized enterprises and 22% for our investment-grade corporates. The continuity of business with those remote working, and I'm sure we can talk about that a bit later, has been absolutely critical. And just to give you a sense of the scale of the volumes that we were experiencing, in our debt management operations, on average, we would take 3,000 calls a day. At the peak, when the crisis was unfolding, we were getting 25,000 to 30,000 calls a day. So that gives you a sense of how we had to pivot all of our operations to deal with more demand. But we've moved 60% of our telephony team to work from home. So getting equipment and kit and surveillance to them to make sure that they can support the teams. We've had to speed up our decision making, and I think we've seen incredible commitment from colleagues across the bank to make sure we're getting the right support in the right place with the right risk discipline to make sure that we can deliver great support. But more than that, we've also recognised this huge pressure for communities. So we've put funding into charities to help them through this period. We've converted our head office at Gogaburn into a food bank, working in partnership with a number of different parties to get support to the most vulnerable members of community. We've put a scheme in place to help the most vulnerable customers calling out to them. So across the board, it's been reacting very quickly and then maintaining that support right the way through the period and to the rest of the year. My hope is that energy, that passion, that support will help us continue to have rapid, agile decision making, which is going to be critical as this evolves going forward.
Thanks, Alison. It sounds like a huge turnaround there. Amber, let's come to you next. It's been another really difficult week, government, and lots of confidence issues. Tell us about what's happening there.
Thank you, Craig. Yes, another challenging week for the government, and it looks like it's going to continue that way. The centrepiece always at the end of the conference season is the Prime Minister's speech, and they managed to get a reasonable amount of publicity around it. But really, it was neither sort of outstandingly good nor outstandingly bad, which is not a bad achievement given the chaos, really, that is all around us. The issues remain for the government about health, COVID-19, as you said in your introductory remarks, and also Brexit. But the consequence of those two is jobs. And only the Chancellor is the one who's really saying this is about jobs, and he's right to focus on it, because listening to what Alison just had to say and talking to other chief executives, we know that this second wave or the first wave that never went away, etc., particularly in the hospitality sector with the curfews, etc., and Scotland going into lockdown, is going to have a consequence in jobs. And from a political point of view, Rishi is always seen as the heir apparent, and that is absolutely correct, but he will be judged on whether he manages to stave off a real job tsunami. And we've talked before on this call about the fact that government was preparing when it was in lockdown for the prospect of unemployment of 4 or even 4.5 million. And those were confidential numbers, really. And now they are being put out there with much more wary confidence that we could be getting to that stage. So from a strategic point of view for the government, these are really difficult times. The prospect of such high unemployment would be incredibly damaging, whatever the circumstances, and these are extraordinary circumstances. A government that oversees unemployment growth of that level will lose popularity very, very fast. And the other theme that is coming through is that Boris Johnson's government is supposed to be levelling up. And by that, it means focusing on some of the northern seats. And of course, it is the northern area that is being most badly affected by COVID and is having the largest amount of lockdowns. And here we come to another point, which is much more a result of how government is deciding to act rather than circumstances that they can't control, upsetting everything around them. And that is the level of centralisation of this government. All governments come in and think that they can do it differently and that they can centralise. The Labour government in 1997 spent the first 2 years thinking that it could centralise everything and run it from the centre when it realised it really couldn't. This government, with its 80-seat majority, still thinks it can do that. And it is being found out because of the COVID, because of COVID-19 and consequences around it rather earlier than it would have other been. The key issue here is going to be whether it has the confidence to devolve. We've already got local mayors coming out absolutely furious that they're reading about the lockdown before they are actually being consulted on them. And MPs take the same view. MPs who represent their own constituencies do not like being sidelined to the degree that they are. Earlier, we had a small revolution in Parliament on the rule of six. Coming up will be a further one on whether the lockdown curfew of 10 p.m. is legitimate. Parliament is finally revolting. Yes, you heard that right. It is finally finding its own way and making sure that it has a route to actually object to some of this centralisation. And I think we will see more of that. This is going to be difficult times for the government, but there have been difficult times before, and actually everybody has pulled their punches in the end. Will the backbench MPs pull their punches this time on the 10 p.m. curfew, on the agriculture bill, which is coming next week, on a number of controversial legislative issues, which will be coming during the next few weeks? This will be the testing time for whether the number 10 operation can persuade the MPs to come with them. And since they have put almost no effort into that relationship, number 10 to MPs, which you, Craig, will know is a very important one, you neglect it at your peril. If they continue not to win people over, there will be some difficult, potentially losing legislation during the next few weeks, which is the last thing a government in this situation really wants. Final word, if I may, on back to the Prime Minister's speech at conference. He tried to change the subject, make it all about a green industrial revolution. Many of us are very pleased to see that. There's been some sort of snarking about the fact that it's only 160 million in new money. True, but the really important thing here is that government has signalled strong support for that direction, i.e. investing in green technology, investing in future renewable sources of energy. And I think that is a very strong pointer for businesses that there will be more money and more policy going in that direction. Thank you.
Thanks, Amber. I'm resisting the urge to make jokes about Parliament always being revolting, but I'm going to move on to Ruth now. Ruth, you're as a journalist in this, you must have seen the way that your job actually operates change dramatically and the themes that you're covering change. Can you just take us through that a bit?
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for having me. So as you say, Craig, we've seen the way that we work change really dramatically, and I want to talk in some depth about what we expect from British business, which was the question you raised in your introduction. But I think we are a business ourselves, and you know, we've seen how we operate really change in very radical ways. It's been a great achievement, I think, without boasting too much, to actually put out an entire paper remotely. You know, we've done that at the height of lockdown from our back bedrooms and our kitchen tables. And we've had to be very adaptable, and we have that in common, I think, with other businesses. Now, again, I think in common with lots of other businesses, we decided that just subject out wasn't nearly enough. We wanted to still do what we think is brilliant journalism, we hope. So, I mean, a great thing in lockdown, we actually overtook The Sun to be Britain's biggest selling daily and Sunday paper. So that was great back in May. But we also decided that, you know, it wasn't enough just to report, that we wanted to help. So our Mailforce campaign has been hugely successful in getting PPE through to NHS staff, and that's still going on. And I feel strongly, Geordie Gregg, our newish editor, he's done an interview with GQ, which is out at the moment, which I would urge anyone who's interested in the Mail's approach to things, have a look at that. And he's saying very strongly, you know, we do want to be a force for good in COVID, but, you know, more generally than that, in society. Now, my next point, I mean, really the big point about all of this, I think, is there are huge ethical questions that have been raised by the pandemic. I was reflecting on this. I was rereading Milton Friedman's famous essay, where people will remember he said that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits, and anything beyond that is basically just communism. Now, I would absolutely at the moment reject that idea. I think one of the big questions and one of the big expectations I have of businesses is, what do British businesses owe to Britain? Now, Alison's predecessors have had plenty of experience of this. You know, you can't claim to be tooth and claw capitalists and then socialise your losses. And of course, we've now got sort of huge aid, rightly, from the Chancellor going out to businesses. And I think businesses need to be asking themselves that question. And you know, there are kind of new dilemmas coming up. So today I was interested that Tesco was being hauled over the coals for paying out a big dividend. Normally, obviously, that would be pure cause for celebration because shareholders and pension holders are getting money flowing in. Tesco was being lambasted for it on the grounds that they'd taken government help in terms of business rates relief. So I think there are lots of new questions out there that, you know, I don't always agree with some of my colleagues about where do we stand on that. You know, we argue about this a lot ourselves in leader conference and in our own offices. But there are new ethical dilemmas for businesses, business people coming up. And I think also for the government, I was very struck by some of Rishi Sunak's language. You know, he said that the Conservative government had a sacred responsibility to future generations to sort out this level of debt. So it is there are moral questions in a very big way, I think. On the trends that we've seen since COVID, there's obviously been huge disruption of working practices and behaviour. And I think both employment law and our expectations of how employees and employers interact are also coming under question there. You know, what are firms' responsibilities to their employees when you've got this dramatic change in working patterns? And I think you've actually got two quite distinct issues. You've got working in a pandemic, and you've also got longer term changes there as well. We've seen some other things, lots of bids and deals happening at the moment. I think that's some companies are possibly bargain hunting. I think you've also got lots of businesses looking to reconfigure themselves, either wanting or needing to because of COVID. And I think you have businesses to an extent, whilst being hugely grateful for the support that they've been offered, I do sense beginning of loss of patience and confusion and feeling that if you tell us what the framework is, we're very adaptable, we'll do it, but we can't keep constantly moving that kaleidoscope and shifting. You know, we need to know where we are. And I'd like to end really actually on an optimistic note, because my own experience working here and the lots of chats, you know, daily I'm talking to business people, and I have not ceased to be impressed with just how adaptable, how resilient our entrepreneurs are, whether those are in big businesses or small people. It's just astonishing, you know, from the local pubs to the leaders of Tesco, it's all brilliant stuff and, you know, so committed. And I do think in the long term, that spirit of enterprise is going to prevail. And I am optimistic about Britain and about the British economy and about British business.
Thanks, Ruth. That was fascinating. Lots to pick up there. Anna, you were already seeing massive changes in society before COVID took hold, and that's only just been accelerated. Can you talk about the impact on that on your business?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. I've only been in the job a year and came on board to help transform a brand that was very well known as Weight Watchers, but less well known as WW. And a brand that was trying to transform from being so focused on weight to really looking at health and well-being. And coronavirus came along and kind of accelerated the transformation for us, really. And it did it for a number of reasons, because people are much more now aware about their health and wellness than ever before. We know that people are now more focused around their weight because of the link to coronavirus. And we know that people are struggling working and living at home and looking for help and solutions, but they need the content providers to deliver that to them in their homes. So there needed to be a move towards a digital business. And as a business, as I say, we were looking to transform anyway. You know, we really wanted to move away from it just being singly focused on weight, and thinking around the mindset piece, which is terribly relevant now around how people are struggling with mental health and stress and lack of sleep and anxiety, and how physical exercise is terribly important. So for us to move away just from it being weight, we called ourselves WW as opposed to Weight Watchers. And fortunately, I guess, it is very relevant now, because people are looking for more support than just focusing on what they're eating to kind of look after their weight. So as a brand, it's been really, really interesting. And, you know, I'm still new. I'm still only a year in, but we wanted to make a big change. And this virus has, it because of how consumers are behaving, has probably made us even more relevant and made the transformation that we wanted to make into being a more holistic health and wellness brand more relevant and more acceptable. It's also meant for us a lot of things running a business. We ran over 4,500 workshops a week before coronavirus. That was an hour a week, 4,500 of them right across the country with what we call our coaches running a physical experience. Well, clearly that all changed in March, and we had to make a very quick decision to say, how do we still deliver a support for our members, but in a new way? And as a business, we were working using Zoom, which is, you know, I think a phenomenal piece of technology. I know we're on Teams now, but, and so we all knew how it worked, and we moved every single one of our workshops into a Zoom experience. Clearly, one of the challenges is that a lot of our members have no idea what Zoom is. So we also had a whole education process to do to take people on that journey. So we had to move a physical business into a digital business overnight in 6 days, which we did. It also meant that all of the tech that we've got behind this app, because now over, and this has changed since coronavirus, over half of our members now are coming through from the app as opposed to that interaction, whether it be a live interaction in a workshop or through Zoom. It's accelerated the tech development to mean that we've focused on making the app even more brilliant. So what it's done for us is it's consumers have moved and they've got a broader need. We're very relevant because everyone is worried about their health and wellness and particularly their weight. People need a digital solution. It's made us absolutely focus on what is really essential, which is delivering a digital experience. And it's meant that we've also been able to be a bit more creative, because delivering exercise classes in physical workshops is quite tough, or cooking demonstrations with the health and safety regulations you have to follow. Well, doing it through a Zoom is really easy. Someone in a kitchen with their iPhone can show you how to make a healthy, delicious meal, or one of our fitness experts can show you how to do yoga or meditation in their sitting room. That's actually easier to deliver through digital than it was through physical. So our business, I would say, was transforming anyway. Coronavirus has accelerated that transformation. And it's not just the experience that we deliver. Obviously, you know, we employ a lot of people, not as big as NatWest, but, you know, we do employ a lot of people and they're all home working, all using Zoom. But it's definitely putting a stress on and strain on people. And we're trying to be creative. We're networking, looking at what other businesses are doing to help look after the mental well-being of our employees. We opened the office up in a flexible manner a few months ago where people could come back, but then we kind of closed it down when Boris made the latest announcement. But we did, I had a lot of people email me saying, please, can I still go in even just for a bit, because I just can't bear being at home on my own anymore. So we're not obviously just focused on our customers and the business delivery, but also on our employees and how we can support them. So there's a lot of challenges, but it has accelerated things for us as a business.
Okay, thank you, Anna. That's fascinating. I want to start on a practical thing. I'm actually in the office today, and usually there are about 300 people here, and I think I'm one of four people who are in the office, and it had gone up for a bit about a month ago. But Alison and Anna, you're both running businesses from your home at the moment, and what are the practicalities of that, and how difficulties you're finding, and are there any advantages to it? So Alison, do you want to start with that?
Yeah, I mean, we've got around 20% of our colleagues back in the office. So I have a couple of days in the office a week. I mean, I think that sort of practical challenges are the fact that, you know, I live where I work now. So my day gets longer and, you know, you're on Zoom pretty much constantly. So you're incredibly well connected, but what you're missing is the sidebar conversations, the collaboration conversations that you would get with if you're in the office. But I think what has been evident is that you can run a business incredibly efficiently in this way. So that continuity of service points. The big challenge, and I've in particular have had it, I've onboarded, you know, new members of my team. That's really tough to onboard people remotely because you don't have the social capital to rely on that you've built up over a number of years. So I think from an extended period, that's a challenge. How do I keep innovation and collaboration going when people are very remote? And so it's getting that balance between people safe and well, continuity of service, and then creativity and innovation going forward. But I think what the technology has allowed us to do, the level of investment in tech has allowed us to be incredibly efficient and agile. I would echo the points around my concern around mental health and well-being. It's a real strain on people. So for some people, it's been a fantastic experience not having to commute. Productivity levels are back to where they were before, but for other people, the experience has been absolutely isolating. Home experience has been very difficult. For the younger generation who typically learn on the job, you know, working in a sit with a computer on their lap, that is not a great experience. So I think the challenge from a leadership perspective is recognizing each person's experience is very difficult and being able to create the agility in your business model to be able to deal with that and the sort of demands and the peaks and troughs that are going to come again. I know, for example, come October, November, December, those call volumes into my call centers are going to go through the roof again as the government schemes come to an end because we will get a peak. And that's a massive, massive burden on individuals as well as operational capability.
Nana, how are you finding running WW from home?
Yeah, I mean, very similar thoughts to Alison. I'm convinced that the solution will be flexible working, and I hope it will be the normal, be 2 to 3 days a week in the office, because for me, there needs to be a blend of both. Zoom is exhausting. It's almost like a performance platform, where as a leader, you need to really kind of find ways to kind of bring people to life, because otherwise it can be very flat. So it can be, I think, quite exhausting as a leader. I think in a good way, what it does do is it gives everyone a voice, because everyone's the same size square on Microsoft Teams as they are on Zoom. So I like the fact that there's an equality coming through in a way that people can step forward if they're confident enough and speak. But without a doubt, the bit that no one's come up with yet is those, exactly as Alison said, those side conversations or those conversations that evolve into another topic. You just cannot do in this format. And that is something that I think all businesses are going to, you know, feel the weakness for, because it's just a big miss. So it's hugely challenging. Again, for me, I'm with my family, I'm with my kids. You know, there is definitely something good about that. And I think everyone's a bit more relaxed, which is probably nice. And we do spend more time at the start of each call. Well, I guess we did that in the office anyway, but kind of like, how are you? Because that can easily be missed. What did you get up to? And that softer chat, which I think is important, and we're trying to practice that. And also using the technology, there's breakout groups, there's polls, there's all sorts of things you can do on this platform that maybe we don't use enough. So we're trying to use that a lot more. But it's challenging. I think overall, it's good for work life, flexible working, because I think our patterns will change going forward, which is positive.
Ruth, there's something I want to pick up, and I'm going to go to each of you on this point, but start with you, Ruth. You were saying about how business is struggling with everything just changing all over the place and how tough that is. You've been very critical of that a lot as a newspaper. Do you not think that there's an inevitability of that with government, or do you think they have had particular problems?
Well, I think, you know, being fair and being realistic about this, This is a new virus. This is an unprecedented situation. So of course it's hugely difficult, and of course you want to see responsiveness. You know, you don't want some kind of rigid approach with people refusing to change at all. And so I think a certain amount of changing and flexibility and adaptability. And I wouldn't even use the word inevitable. I think that probably is something that should happen. But I just think at the moment, it's gone far too far, You know, people just don't know where they are. Nobody understands. Even government spokesmen, when they appear on the media, don't actually always appear to understand the rules that ought to apply. So how can you be expected to? And I think businesses have absolutely stepped up here. So, you know, when I talk to people, they've spent small fortunes or large fortunes on making their offices COVID safe, on making their premises, their shops, their pubs, their restaurants safe for customers and for their staff. And then the rules change again. So I think there's got to be, you know, some more sensible path that can be forged than we're actually achieving at the moment. Or, you know, look at the airline industry. The last thing we need is another task force on testing, isn't it? I mean, you know, we just can't, I think people cannot process infinite change, constant change all the time.
Amber, one thing you'll have seen though about being in government in all your years of experience, it sometimes feels like there's an awful lot of everybody else and not very many of you when you're in government. And it's one of the myths, isn't it, that there's this vast teams of people with infinite resources. I mean, the reality is they are being hit on one side by the epidemiologists, by the changing events. Or do you think that there has been a particular incompetence here in terms of telling business what to do?
I think it's one of those situations where we all long for certainty and for clarity. And the nature of what we're being hit with, the virus, means that we can't have it. So I'm sympathetic from that point of view. But I come back to the point I made earlier, which is the government makes it harder for itself by acting in such a centralised manner and making all the decisions at the centre and then declaring that this is how it's going to be with absolute confidence, which turns out to be totally misplaced. So I think that within the framework of being in a situation which changes the whole time, the nature of how they're dealing with it, i.e. totally centralised, not engaging enough with the mayors in the decision making, not engaging enough with the MPs in either the decision making or the communications, is stepping up the difficulties for businesses and for people complying and generally leaving them muddled. So I think they're making it worse, but it is a difficult situation.
And Alison, how have you found that? Do you feel pulled around or do you feel that there is enough consistency to give you the sort of conditions you need to continue forward?
In some ways it's easier for me because I've set some very clear distinctions around, you know, health and well-being of my staff and continuity of business service. So, you know, I'm doing enough to operate through that period. I think Ruth's point is right. I think for small and medium-sized businesses who do not have huge resources, you know, the uncertainty is incredibly difficult. And I have been, you know, hugely impressed by the ability of businesses to pivot and be very entrepreneurial to respond very quickly. But they don't have huge, vast amounts of resources to do that. And for a lot of the small businesses that I talk to, and I do lots of conversations around tables with them, you know, in the summer, they were feeling more optimistic. You know, conversations with right the way across different sectors saying we're back at 80-90% of pre-COVID volumes, profitability, you know, very uncertain looking forward, but we're coping and we're being more productive and managing with less people. You shut me down for another 3 months, that's it, we're done. So there isn't, you know, we've got to recognise the capacity of particularly small and medium sized businesses, which are absolutely the kind of key driver of the economy, their ability to move very quickly and respond very quickly when they've already put a huge amount of resource into this. But I think, you know, as business leaders, we're all having to make choices. I made a choice very early on that I was going to move people out of the office. The number of people I would leave in, and I haven't changed that because I need to give certainty to my colleagues and certainty to customers. And so I think leaders are having to make their own choices and their own decisions as they go through this to deal with what is a very, very uncertain and rapidly evolving environment.
And Anna, are you finding a lot of energy and effort is spent dealing with things that then switch around? I mean, the classic example is the encouragement back into the office that seems to be drifting away.
Yeah, do you know, it is challenging that, because we felt very comfortable about, we put all the security measures in, as was referred to earlier, at a cost, and people quite liked the idea of going back in for a bit, and then it was very much advised, don't go in unless it's essential, so we pulled back. And that actually is frustrating for people. I think the other added complication is if you're a part of a global organization, you know, different countries are dealing with this differently. And globally, an organization might want to take a position on how they want to work from a flexible working practice. And that can be really challenging because they might be saying one position that ultimately you want to be able to flex locally slightly differently. So, you know, it's something that still needs resolving, I think, and sorting out.
Right. I want to come to probably the biggest issue of all. It seems to me that for a long time, the economy was sort of wrapped in cotton wool, and we're now coming to a time where, you know, the furlough scheme's being unwound. We had speeches this week at the Conservative Party conference that were heavily hinting that there's going to be tax rises, the public spending can't go on at the level that it has. And I just want to talk a bit about that to each of you in turn, because it feels like autumn and winter is going to be a difficult period. Amber, the government must be deeply concerned about this. And do you think it's done enough to prepare people for the reality of what's coming?
The issue for the government is when the tax rises are going to come. I mean, everybody accepts there's going to have to be some tax rises, but they will start from the point of, OK, we've got a general election in 2024. We don't want to be putting up taxes just ahead of that. And yet we can't put up taxes right now, obviously, if that has been accepted. So it seems to me that they're going to continue to signal it, but gently. And then at the very earliest, we will see anything, the shape of anything that's going to be coming will be towards the end of next year, possibly the year after. Meanwhile, they'll be praying for growth to recover and for inflation to pick up a little, which will try offset some of the need for higher taxes. But it is a case of the old St. Augustine quote, not quite yet, I feel.
Ruth, one of the jobs it strikes me of the Daily Mail is to reflect what it thinks Middle England is thinking. And I suspect in the winter period, when we start seeing high rise in unemployment, you know, businesses going to the wall, that kind of thing, the mood is not going to be fantastic. How do you think you're going to handle that as a paper, and what do you think your role is in that?
So I think how we'll handle it as a paper is how we always handle things. We try to, you know, be fair and also be critical in a constructive way when that's merited. My role, I think, is, you know, I'm try to be close to businesses and to business leaders and to be a bit of a conduit for that, and to be and you know, hopefully to bring a bit of expertise on the economy into leader conferences and inform the paper's views. I mean, it's very interesting actually, because I mean, just if you'll forgive me a slight personal note, I was actually brought up on Teesside in the 1970s and 80s. So I lived through mass unemployment, and my father lost his job. And sadly, I saw that, you know, firsthand the really awful toll this takes on families. And there's a generation now who've been lucky enough not to have experienced it. You know, we had record high employment before COVID. And, you know, I think people perhaps don't quite know how bad that can be. And I think it's hugely important that we do everything that we can, that we try our hardest to retrain people. It's incredibly difficult to go from losing a job in retail to suddenly becoming, you know, nuclear engineer or a wind farm engineer or something like that. You know, we've got a big pivot to do. And, you know, I just think I'm actually, again, fairly optimistic about the potential of the economy to bounce back. Andy Haldane, who's the chief economist of the Bank of England, as people will know, has actually been quite optimistic and has warned, you know, don't let pessimism take hold, otherwise you just make matters worse. And, you know, without being silly about it, I think, you know, that resilience, that adaptability will stand us in good stead. But, you know, we need to do the right things now.
So, Alison, earlier in this week, we saw the National Audit Office saying that, you know, the bounce back loans had had lots of problems with it. You're also, I think, on your books, you've got a huge number of small and medium-sized businesses, that kind of thing. Can you tell us about your preparedness for this coming and how difficult it's going to be? Because a lot of people are going to be expecting that you're going to actually try and keep things afloat and that kind of thing. So it must be a very difficult thing for you to handle and manage.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be I think the reality is they're going to be very tough times ahead. In normal circumstances, businesses fail all the time. And, you know, I think we're going to find a lot of businesses that aren't going to survive this period, either because the market that they were in no longer exists or they're not able to cope with that. And we've put a huge amount of debt into businesses through these different schemes that businesses have to pay back. Now they've got time to do that, but not all businesses are going to survive. I mean, we've been, you know, very conscious of that. I mean, you can't keep zombie businesses going. That is not in the long-term health of the economy, but you've got to put the right support measures in to help businesses if they can evolve and if they can survive. So we've, you know, from the very beginning, we've been scaling up our debt management operations, training people to prepare to deal with that situation. We've been very careful in terms of explaining, you know, how much debt people are taking on and the consequences of that and the treatment methods of that. But the reality is, you know, we are going to be facing some really difficult times ahead because those loans are going to fall due and they are government loans. We're acting on behalf of them. There are going to be parts of sectors that are going to really struggle. And to Ruth's point, there's going to be unemployment. Now, I'm still in the positive camp as well. I'm seeing businesses pivot massively in terms of evolving their business models to survive and to operate in the new paradigm. And, you know, at the end of the day, what you're seeing is some acceleration of existing trends that were there. The retailers, you know, there's a real bifurcation between businesses that are going to survive and businesses that don't. In retail, those businesses that have already moved to a very digital e-commerce model are not doing badly. You know, those businesses that haven't and are still, you know, very paper-based or analog or haven't evolved their business model are the ones that are going to really struggle. And so you're going to get a number of things happening at the same time. But scaling up support, being realistic, you know, our relationship managers have all been trained to deal with this and support them. But we must be realistic in recognizing that not every business is going to survive this period.
And Anna, difficult times coming for your members. How are you seeing that manifest itself? Is it affecting things or is there anything particular that you feel you need to do because of that?
Yeah, I mean, because our members are representative of the population. So yes, we're all going to have some difficult times ahead. As a business, what we need to do is to make sure that we're there for them as much as possible. So we need to make sure that we're adding value to our proposition so that when someone joins us that they're feeling that they're getting more for their money. So whether that be, as I say, for us it's about, you know, recipes, it's about exercise, it's about sleep, it's about a lot of content that they can get, so that we're over servicing, I hope, to add more value. I think what we're also exploring is partnerships. So there's a lot of businesses out there that are trying to make a positive difference to people's lives. How do we do that together so that we can do it more economically and also make it more easy for consumers to navigate? Because, you know, there are ways of us working with another brand. So instead of necessarily having to have two subscriptions, you can have one subscription. So we need to think about how we can smartly partner with other brands to help consumers get what they want, but at a more affordable price. We need to lean into, and we are, the government are doing a huge amount to try and tackle obesity. So working with them so that people that are at the end of being severely obese or at risk of developing diabetes, they should be able to access the service for free, which they can. And we need to do more of that. And the government are looking to do more of that. So we totally support that. So we need to really look at adding value, working with partners and trying to make our product accessible to all is really, really key for us.
I want to move on to purpose, which I think actually was Ruth that you brought up and asked you all about that. I mean, if you're being cynical, like this is such a huge event that is going on and we're facing enormous issues with the economy. Is it really the case that businesses and government have got enough bandwidth to properly deal with purpose and social responsibility during this time? Amber, I'm going to come to you. I mean, it seems to me that every time you bring up anybody in government, their bandwidth is just completely taken up and they things that are quite significant problems they feel they just can't touch. Do you want to start?
I think that's exactly what's going on. I mean, again, coming back to my theme that given that everything is very centralised, that makes it even worse. So they haven't sort of devolved various decision making to the local mayors or the local councils. But it does mean that all the sort of the key issues that this government was elected on, like the infrastructure, like levelling up, etc., are getting pushed back because it's about survival day to day. And every department is just really struggling with having any capacity to look ahead. Instead, they're just dealing every day with urgent questions, with new challenges, with trying to go on the radio and defend something which half of them know isn't quite true. So it's a real struggle for the government at the moment to be able to hold the line of certainty and confidence. And the point that Ruth made is so good is we all have to exude that confidence, because otherwise we will bring difficulty by default. And I think that's part of the problem that government's got. It's trying to appear confident at a time when things are moving so fast, it can't have a solution to everything.
And Ruth, I imagine your inbox is filled up with press releases from people telling everybody how wonderfully socially responsible they've been. Do you buy that that's really happening at the moment, or are businesses just peddling hard to keep up?
So I think that the businesses who had social responsibility front and centre before the pandemic still have ramped that up. And I think the people who were cynically peddling it are still cynically peddling it. I've been actually really impressed with some of the things that business has done. Kurt Geiger, one example, and they weren't particularly plugging this in press releases. I just was talking to their boss. They gave away £5 million worth of stock of shoes to NHS workers, for instance. Which you might say, well, okay, maybe they wouldn't have sold that anyway, because who was buying stilettos in the middle of a pandemic? But it was just a creative way of dealing with that. And if I was a nurse on the ward, I would just have loved a nice pair of pink stilettos. It would cheer you up. So I have actually been impressed with some of what I've seen. And I think, it's quite genuine. I mean, people are not operating businesses, particularly small businesses, in a kind of social vacuum of uncaring or pure commerce. People are running businesses as part of communities. They've got, the sister of the boss of Kurt Geiger is a nurse. So, of course, it's in people's families. And businesses is small business, and big business too, hopefully, is part of that community. So, to some degree, yeah, I'm a little bit cynical about some of the ESG stuff that you get, because you think, well, businesses ought, as a matter of course, to be behaving honestly and in a socially responsible and helpful way. But I think I'm seeing a lot of really quite genuine stuff that I hope will take a broader route, really. And as I mentioned, the Mail is doing this. We've a long tradition, as you all know, as a campaigning newspaper, and we've taken this to heart and are trying to do our best ourselves. I'm about to launch, I hope in the next few weeks, something else for small businesses to help small firms. So, I think genuinely people are doing their bit.
And Alison, 6 months before the pandemic, you announced yourself as a business leader that was very, very much interested in purpose and saw it actually as integral to the businesses actually making money and generating cash as well. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it's fundamental. We launched a purpose-led strategy, because I think if you are, singly there for just one element of making profits, I don't think you're a sustainable business. So we focused on financial education and inclusion, climate and enterprise as three focus areas, and balancing, driving value for all of our stakeholders. And that is a genuine commitment that we've made, and it's actually guided us enormously through this crisis. And I think it comes absolutely to the fore of what business should be doing. As a bank providing capital into the economy, we have a really critical role to support families and people and businesses navigate through this period for the long term. So that, that means some of our decision making, as I said, was not business as usual. We have to pivot to really support small businesses. We've put a huge amount of support, whether it is, the partnership with the Prince's Trust to help you know, young people start businesses through this period. We've had 9,000 that we've already helped just in this short period. Do the advice and help we're giving to small businesses to help them navigate through this period with practical help and support. I think this financial education and inclusion point is fundamental to the rebuild recovery that we need to do across all aspects of the economy. And that's helping people be confident with their money and save, but also supporting the most vulnerable elements of our society as we transition through this period. I mean, it is shocking how poor the financial capability and education and the support that's available to people. And then enterprise and entrepreneurs is one of the biggest ones. And, you know, I think we've made incredible strides, you know, in terms of helping entrepreneurs, getting barriers out of their way. But we absolutely can't let the pandemic put us backwards, and particularly female entrepreneurs who we know are already under-supported and have bigger barriers and less access to financing and VC money. And I'm really pleased that, you know, we announced £1 billion fund in February. Half of it's been already drawn by female entrepreneurs, and we've seen a 600% increase in the funding to female entrepreneurs. So being purpose-driven is strategic part of our strategy and practical help, and I think every business should be doing that, because if you're single-minded about just making profits, of course we've got to be financially viable, but you've got to have a broader sense of your position in the communities and with your colleagues and with families that you support, particularly as a bank. And so that has driven our strategy and our response to the pandemic.
And Anna, it seems to me that your business model is absolutely predicated on the purpose being the same thing, in people being fitter, healthier, interested in wellness.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're really lucky if you have a business whose whole ethos is built around a purpose and you don't have to seek out a purpose. And so we're very fortunate. We're trying to ensure that everyone has the ability to lead a healthy life. And that is what our product delivers. So for that, it's very fortunate. But I also think it's massively important to realise that no one wants to work for a brand that doesn't have a purpose, and it has to be a purpose that people believe in. And we have a lot of young people that work for our business, and they are so passionate about making a difference. And probably at some points, I feel that we've got more passion than we probably even demonstrate. You almost need to kind of pocket it and then try and articulate it slightly in a really creative way. But to keep a motivated workforce, they need to believe in the purpose and feel that they can make a difference. And we're fortunate that as a brand, we change people's lives. People that can't have children, you know, or struggle to get pregnant, or don't want to get married, or don't want to go out and have their photograph taken, or are going to develop diabetes. I mean, life-changing things, and we can help them get over those. So for us, it's massively important, and we treat it with respect.
Okay, we're coming towards the end of the call now. Got a question here from Alicia, and she's saying, a pandemic magnifies existing inequalities. As a panel of inspiring female leaders, what are your thoughts on the burden falling more heavily on women? Is this something you are hearing from your customers and employees, and what can be done about it? So, Amber, I'm going to start with you, but I mean, obviously you're not running a business, but your thoughts on that, the female sides of things?
It worries me on two levels. The first one is that women have been suffering more than men because of the lockdown. The incidences of domestic abuse have been terrible, and the government has been slow to pick up on that. And it is impossible not to observe that the government has an insufficient number of women at senior level to be able to point out the issues that are going to affect families and women more before they actually hit them. And I would point also to some of the decisions over going back to schools and about childcare. Obviously, childcare issues aren't just for women, but often they are. And I think that the government is suffering from not having senior women there. I would say that, I know, wouldn't I? But it is still nevertheless the case. I think that's disappointing. And I think that the pandemic overall has revealed some of these issues. But I would hope, I want to join the group who are being optimistic here. I don't want to be the one on the negative all the time. I would hope that as it reveals some of these truths, the private sector, which is doing so much better in terms of driving women to senior levels, politicians will expect more as well, and the public will expect more, and that we might just see it, some of the balance put back into it. I certainly hope so.
Ruth?
Well, yeah, I completely agree with what Amber said there. And one of the reasons I was so enthusiastic about being on this panel is it's incredibly rare to be on an all-female panel. And I'm used to being in environments still where I'm the only woman, you know, and so it's been just great. And I do agree. And I think, you know, domestic abuse is one thing, you're absolutely right, that hasn't been highlighted enough. But I would say from my own experience when I was on lockdown, that you just end up, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're the business editor or the CEO, you end up just kind of washing more dishes, or at least I do. Maybe I'm weak-minded or something, I don't know. But I think just the domestic burden tended to fall that little bit more on women during the lockdown. And you know, if you're working from home, what I wouldn't want to see looking ahead is that you're doing more than your double shift of domestic work at home, as well as working for your job as a woman. Now, Alison did an absolutely brilliant review, which is how I first met Alison a couple of years ago, on female entrepreneurship. And I think, I'm right, you'll correct me, Alison, if I'm wrong, that 250 billion of value could be added to the UK economy if women set up businesses at the same rate as men. And wouldn't it be fantastic if women could do that and be part, not just be part of, but even lead the economic recovery after COVID? Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Alison, that tees you up very nicely.
Well, look, I agree. I think the review into female entrepreneurship identified, you know, significant barriers to female entrepreneurs accessing funding and getting the same level of support that male-led businesses were getting. And actually, the positive in that story was that the demand is there. There are amazing female entrepreneurs out there. And actually, if we can get the barriers out of the way, then you can unlock this 250 billion opportunity. What we're seeing in our accelerators is almost 50% of those entrants into the accelerators that we've now moved entirely digital, including our Dream Bigger, which is our education program for girls in schools to think about entrepreneurship as a career, have all gone digital and are all oversubscribed. But it would be an absolute disaster if we allowed this pandemic to curtail that opportunity. So I think it's really critical that we keep it right at the top of the agenda. I think that, as I mentioned, that 600% increase in funding to female-led businesses, just because I put £1 billion fund out there and highlighted the issue, shows the underlying demand that is there. But it is inevitable. And I think, you know, I've heard from entrepreneurs and business women and our colleagues that particularly when the schools were closed, that, you know, managing homeschooling as well as running a business as well as the domestic puts a huge burden. So I think it's really important that you examine the whole experience of these business people, but we make sure that right at the forefront, as we're building back, as we're putting the recovery mechanisms in place, female entrepreneurship, female founders, female businesswomen do not get left behind, because the burden, maybe an invisible burden, actually causes different choices. And so I think it's critical we stay right at the forefront of that. And you know, these female entrepreneurs are amazing. My favourite example is the Four Sisters Gin Distillery, that these amazing women who run a gin distillery pivoted to a hand sanitizer and mail order gin. They're top of my list when I'm sending off for hand sanitizer and gin, I'd recommend it. But that gives you an example of the entrepreneurial spirits that there. So I think it's really important that any business leader, any bank, anyone who can support and help should really focus on making sure those barriers aren't exacerbated in the recovery, but we use it as an opportunity to really stimulate the support for them.
The Four Sisters sound great. Anna, just very briefly, a couple of sentences and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, the sentence is, these three ladies said it all. I don't need to repeat it. You know, there are challenges out there for women, but I think that we are confident, getting more confident. I think we're probably a very positive gender, and we will, you know, we'll fight through it and we'll come through. And this, I think this is testament to have the four of us on here who are all feeling fairly positive and resilient at the moment, should hopefully be a sign of the future.
That's a great note to finish on. I've really enjoyed having this in the discussion. We've gone from very serious issues to some inspiring stuff too, so that's been great. We always say at the end of these things is that one of the sadnesses is we can't give a round of applause, but I know that there'll be a virtual standing ovation as ever for what was a fantastic panel. So Anna Hill, Ruth Sunderland, Alison Rose and Amber Rudd, thank you very much. We'll send a link out to this. We've got another great panel next week and we'll be in touch with you on that. But in the meantime, thank you to a fantastic panel and we'll see you soon.